This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You're listening to a Joycast from GLBTIQ community radio station, Joy 94.9.
Okay, folks, panic over. We got the phones fixed finally, and my first guest today is on the line. He has the unenviable job of Planning Minister for Victoria. And I say unenviable because no matter what you do, you're going to upset somebody, whether it's inner city NIMBYs not wanting a block of flats in their backyard or green wedges like me who don't want the view spoiled with another field full of cheap houses. you know, you can't win, can you? Minister for Planning, Guy Matthews. Hello.
Matthew Guy, good morning.
I beg your pardon. I've got your name written the wrong way around. Hello, Matthew. Good morning.
G'day.
I'm sorry about all the runaround.
All right.
Now, as I alluded to there, we're going to see some changes in our natural, not in our natural environment in Melbourne, but in our built environment, because your emphasis is rather different to the previous governments, isn't it?
Well, our view is that population accommodation is something that is not a one-size-fits-all approach or a singular approach, whether it's either through green wedge, growth area development, or whether it's through urban renewal, or whether it's through development in existing suburbs. It is a number of ways which can accommodate population growth in the city. And as I said, the Baillieu government's just committed to focusing on all of those rather than just one at one point in time, which is where we were with the previous regime.
Yeah, well, you've done a little bit of both since you got in, haven't you? Because
you've said
hello to a wind farm. You said okay to wind farms in one place. You said okay to building a marina and a fairly large development down on the coast on another. What about inner urban development? Is any of that coming along?
Well, the wind farm's in Chepstow, so it's not close to Melbourne, and the marina's down near the marina development is Wyndham Harbour, which is the first time we've seen the western suburbs have that style of accommodation or that style of development, which, in my point of view, is a good thing. We don't need the eastern suburbs being the only location for that style of development. We've got Melbourne's west, which rightfully should have the chance to benefit as well. What the government believes is that our growth areas are areas where 60% of people coming to Melbourne want to live, and we obviously need to respond to that growth and that demand, but also urban renewal and around inner urban areas where we have sites like where I was this morning with the Premier kicking off development up in my own electorate in the northern suburbs in Coburg, which is a former Kodak site, is incredibly important for Melbourne. Now, clearly, infrastructure and transport issues are...
I was going to come to that, because we don't have a very good public transport system, and it was one of the things that got you elected, was saying you were going to fix that.
Well, that's right. That's why we've commenced the planning and construction for four additions to the rail network in Victoria. It's to the two airports, to Rovell and to Doncaster. We're completing the South Morang Rail Extension, and we are putting monies forward to commence the construction of the regional rail link in the western part of Melbourne, which has been delayed by the federal government. But the reality is, there's a number of heavy rail projects to come on stream in Melbourne, and those will obviously help with some of the population movement that we need to take place in the coming years.
Well, joining me here in the studio is Tim Wilson from the IPA. Tim, you want to come in here?
G'day, Matthew.
G'day, Tim.
G'day. Now, one of the major issues I know that affects particularly young people is affordable housing and being able to get into the housing market. What are the sorts of policies that are going to be implemented by the government to increase housing stock to reduce prices, or at least keep them, plateau them, so that first home buyers can actually get into the market?
Yeah, it's a very good point. One of the key issues we've found on affordability is, in fact, the time it takes to bring a development on stream. So we've established a housing affordability unit in the Department of Planning. They're focused on cutting down state and local government time constraints in terms of bringing developments to market. But as I said before, also increased the number of housing land lots that can be made available in Melbourne's growth areas. The previous government bought forward about 2,000 new lots of land in growth areas in 2009. This year we'll bring forward about 50,000 next year as well, and that will see some of the addressing of the supply issues that exist in growth areas. But on top of that, we're establishing an urban renewal authority that will be through the Parliament hopefully by the end of the financial year. The urban renewal authority will focus on areas such as Fisherman's Bend for more high density development, possibly Australia's first inner city growth corridor, where we can actually, as I said before, bring that diversity in market stock in terms of different style of housing, whether it's one bedroom apartment, two bedroom apartment, or in growth areas, a detached home. So, you know, Melbourne can offer that different style of housing product to what is becoming an insatiable demand.
Yeah, because I think that's the big problem that everybody has at the moment. I think we've got this massive population growth going on, but rental market is incredibly tight. Affordable housing is incredibly tight. As I know, Tim had an enormous problem finding a flat to afford.
As you read on Facebook, Dan.
And I mean, if even he has trouble finding somewhere to live, you know, good capitalist that he is, then, you know...
A good one, though.
Oh, yes, a good one, definitely. You know, what chance have the rest of us got?
Well, that's the challenge, I think, facing the generation of politicians that I'm in now, and that is to ensure that we do not leave a legacy of affordability that is so out of reach to a generation of young Australians. And why we are doing everything we can, and it's, I have to tell you, on my mind every day, whether it's cousins or staff who are in that generation who aren't homeowners but want to be a homeowner, whether it's an apartment or a house or a unit or a townhouse, and they want that opportunity. Now, that is slipping by them, and successive governments obviously are finding it more and more difficult to manage, but this government won't sit by and do nothing on this increasing problem.
Well, we'll keep a track of that, Matthew.
No worries.
And thank you very much for joining
Pleasure.
Us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
That was Matthew Guy, Planning Minister in the Victorian State Government. Now, our next guest is a Walkley Award-winning senior age journalist who's been visiting climate science frontiers like Antarctica and so forth. And she'll be joining us in a moment. That's Jo Chandler from The Age. The Age is pretty much in the news at the moment, making news all of itself, Tim.
Jobs being slashed all over the place, it certainly is. And, you know, really, I don't know if anybody's seen, there's actually even an article, quite controversially, I'd have to say, in the Herald Sun today of Jeff Kennett saying that The Age will close soon. But it is part of the problem. I mean, it's been a paper that has been in serial decline for years, and you have to wonder when they're going to focus on, you know, fixing the problem.
Well, lots of newspapers are having the same problem, and not just in this country either, but we'll have to follow that one up. A couple of journalists from The Age are going to be on Saturday Magazine discussing this whole thing. That's 10 o'clock on Saturday here on Joy. We also have a senior and award-winning Age journalist on the line with us now, not to talk about that, but to talk about her new book, Feeling the Heat. Good morning and good afternoon, Jo Chandler.
Good afternoon.
Well, where have you been? In other words, where have you not been for this book?
Well, I guess I set out in this book to try to visit the extremities of the climate story and to find the frontiers and see where they're chipping away at the edges of it in the real world sense and collecting data. So when I sat down to think about it, I thought, well, it's a climate story. It's got to be about hot and cold and wet and dry, and I went looking for those places.
So tell us a little bit about who you met when you went to these places. Did you actually go to the people doing the science at the coal face, if that's an unfortunate term in this context?
It is an unfortunate term, but it's pretty much, I basically sort of decided that I wanted to see and work with field scientists so that I could explain scientific process. And my rationale was that in this long-winded so-called climate science debate that we've had for, you know, a decade or 15 years now, what was often missing was the science, and certainly these great rip-snorting yarns of real science out on the edges and the margins. So I took myself off initially to Antarctica and ended up getting two trips down there over two seasons of the summer, which is the peak season for science, with the Australian Antarctic Division, who kindly lugged me down there and let me tag along with the scientists. And then I decided, having got back to the real world again, I took myself off to the Great Barrier Reef to follow some of the scientific narratives, I guess, into the other extreme.
And also to warm up a bit.
And warm up a bit, yes. So, for instance, down in Antarctica, one of the issues that they've been exploring really closely in recent years is the effect of acidification, ocean acidification, mm-hmm. which is often referred to as the other CO2 problem. And so you've got scientists that I met down there who are collecting, trawling nets behind the Aurora Australis, collecting nets full of pteropods, these little tiny shelled creatures mm-hmm. That are right at the bottom of the food chain, and sort of basically weighing them and measuring them against, you know, historic samples to try to figure out whether they're losing mass, yeah. losing shells as a result of an increasing acidity.
So that means their shells are thinner, and therefore
their shells are thinner. Yeah. Yes, and the concern is this because the level of acidity has begun to creep up, and the Southern Ocean, colder oceans, is a place where that phenomenon begins to be felt more profoundly early on because of the cold temperatures. So they're looking at that down there, and then by catching a couple of planes and then ending up on Heron Island on the Great Barrier Reef.
Ah, beautiful place.
Absolutely stunning, and I connected myself in there with a team being led by Ove Hoeg-Goldberg, a very distinguished Australian marine biologist, who is looking at the effect of acidification in warm waters and what does that mean for corals. And so they've created this unique world-first experiment, which actually David Attenborough sent a team over to look at the same time as I was mm-hmm. there, where they're creating these little underwater chambers, creating little mini environments on the living coral bed, where they pump in the level of water at the acid level that's anticipated at the end of the century, and to see the effect of that in a real living environment, and do the corals adapt? Can they survive? Is nature more resilient than the laboratory models often might tell us? So, because in the laboratory you can never be really sure of all of the things that are going on.
Joe, this is Tim Wilson from the IPA. I just want to say firstly, I'm incredibly jealous of your trip. It sounds fantastic. But the second part is, this is part of the great challenge, isn't it, about the whole scientific discussion about climate change, is there are so many knowns and unknowns, and we're trying to map together pieces of a very large puzzle. One of the key parts of that, and you've already talked about it, is data collection. Mm. How have you found the experience of scientists on the front line trying to collect data to fill in parts of this map?
Well, this is what I found. This is the aspect of the scientific story that not a lot of people are familiar with, and which, to me, these are the modern explorers. The process itself is, if that's what you're asking about, incredibly painstaking, mind-numbing sometimes. if you're doing a field survey for possums in a rainforest in far north Queensland, you're basically walking up and down in the dark with your torch, looking for eyes shining back at you.
Did you do that?
Yes, did that, and then you do that at a 600-metre level, at a 700-metre level, at an 800-metre level, and you're doing that with teams every night, every season, and comparing the data from 30 years ago with what you're finding now, and really painstaking work in relation to the Antarctic efforts. You've got scientists wandering around these little islands where the Adélie penguins live, scraping poo off the rocks, in order to figure out what krill, how much krill they're consuming, and where the krill's gene pool came from. Is it changing? Then this season, I think this coming season, they're going to install CCTV all through the winter so that they can actually really closely watch the movements of the Adélies and track the phenology when, the invisible things that we never see that occur in the dark of winter. When do the penguins come in? When do they fledge? When do they, partner up with their mates, and how does that all occur? Because the scientists arrived with the sun, and this other story has been invisible, and so we'll, in the next few years we'll be seeing the secret life of the Adélies.
And talking about poo collection in Antarctica, are they having trouble with the data they're collecting, then comparing it because with previous data and accuracy associated with that, and are they finding challenges in making sure that the data is consistent and showing trends?
Well, obviously, the scientific process, you know, is you know, an incredibly rigorous, ongoing, self-correcting, sometimes flawed process. But, you know, for over 350 years since, I think it was Francis Bacon cooked it up, it's as, you know, as good as we've got, like democracy, I guess. You know. And look, you know, it certainly, you know, the people doing this work, you know, are innately sceptical people. They and they're competitive, and they're wanting to look at what a scientist might have, you know, hypothesised last year, and then looking at through their own prism and challenging that. They challenge themselves. And when you see them, you know, at work, and whether they're picking up the penguin poo or photographing these little mosses that they've been visiting every year for 10 years and trying to figure out how they're changing, you know, they're always questioning. They don't leap to, you know, a particular, you know, they're not pursuing a particular answer saying that's what I want to prove. They're there sort of saying, challenging themselves, okay, here's my hypothesis, in the classic way that we're all taught in high school science works, and where, you know, does the data fit that? And then I guess, you know, often, you know, and modelling, of course, is one of the really difficult evolving areas of the climate story. But now in places like about Antarctica, you've got 30 or so years of satellite record to begin to use to get some real depth in the analysis than you apply to the deep record that you're pulling out with the ice cores from places like Vostok. So
that's a completely and utterly fascinating story, and I'm sure we're all going to love having a look at this book of yours. It's called Feeling the Heat. It's from the Melbourne University Press, and I've put a link to the catalogue online on my blog so people can find it. And thank you very much for joining us today, Jo Chandler.
No problem at all. Thanks for having me.
You're more than welcome.
That was Jo Chandler, award-winning age journalist. She's written this amazing book about climate change.
After an amazing trip, I think.
I think it's a great way to take a sabbatical, isn't it?
Oh, it sounds very pleasant to me.
You know, well, apart from the scraping up poo bit. I think I could have done without that. There could have been worse things to do.
This is true.
Oh, well, never mind.
You can find more Joycast and show blogs. Go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.